and more times than I can count, I have called you mine. You have stood by me in my
life from New York City. It's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. Today, we're going to take a look at pomegranate and how it can turn off inflammation in the body, the amazing health benefits of tomatoes that should make them an important part of your diet, which foods to eat or avoid to prevent late age vision loss, which is very rampant now, and a hygienic practice most people ignore. And I'll tell you why. It could make a big difference in helping prevent allergies and other problems. And a key study proves again that cannabis can slow cancerous tumor growth, and a lot more on health and healing, always from important scientific literature. From our environmental segment today, we're going to look at drought and what the drought is doing around the world that can impact us. Also, a new law facilitates privatization of the U.S. water systems. That's not a good thing. And a secret internal document I'll share with you urging the closure of the California nuclear power plant, the Diablo II plants, and yet this was kept from the American public. You'll hear about it today. We have a lot of listeners in California, and especially around Los Angeles, where I was on our sister station, KPFK, for 31 years. So I'll give you the latest on that. Also, plundering the planet, rigged corporate free trade partnerships, and climate change agreements. I'll show why we should not be supporting any of these. And if time permits, a shocking picture of what life will look like when you cannot afford to retire. The guest in my second part of the program today will be the Vice President of Farm and Animal Protection for the Humane Society. And we're going to talk about the U.S. government's agricultural gag laws and the popular threat to factory farms. In other words, if you tell the truth about animal cruelty, you can go to jail. How'd that happen? Also, a shorter commentary today on how many military families have to rely upon food pantries to meet their basic needs, and the toxic legacy of uranium mining in New Mexico. We have a lot to share. Tomorrow I'm going to talk about Monsanto and Ukraine. You didn't know there was a connection? There's a huge connection to what's going on right now in Ukraine and Monsanto. Also, you may think you have nothing to hide, but you're still breaking laws which government spying could discover and use against you. Last evening on the Progressive Commentary Hour, I had a really insightful guest for a half hour talking about, a professor of constitutional law, why you should never, under any circumstances, talk with the police unless you have your lawyer present. You think that you haven't done anything wrong? You think that telling them the truth will help you? It won't. It'll only hurt you. So I'll bring you up to date on that. Let's begin. Pomegranate became popular about 5 years ago. It became a superfood. Since then, thousands of studies have been done to show why we should be consuming pomegranate, the little flesh, the orbs, or the juice or powder. It's all good. This is just the latest from England's University of Huddersfield and the University of Freiburg in Germany. They both found that inside of the pomegranate are polyphenol compounds, and they inhibit damage inside the brain. They stop the neuroinflammation that's activated when you have a French fry or alcohol or some other food or beverage or even polluted air. Now, central nervous system immune cells that play a role in Alzheimer's disease also are impacted when you have inflammation of any kind. So therefore, this is turning off the inflammation, hence helping prevent Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, dementia. And this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Molecular Nutrition and Food Research. In a series of experiments, they found that this active ingredient in pomegranate inhibited the production of inflammatory compounds, the tumor necrosis factor alpha, interleukin 6, and prostaglandin E2. Quote, these results suggest that there is an inhibition of the neuroinflammation in LPS-activated microglia through interference with NKB signaling, suggesting its potential as a nutritional preventative strategy in neurodegenerative disorders, end quote. In lay language, when you take pomegranate, drink the juice, eat the pomegranate, you are turning off inflammation in your brain. Tomatoes are one of nature's most perfect foods, and I always enjoy the kind of tomatoes, there are thousands of varieties, especially the heirlooms, grown around the world. But most people don't eat a lot of tomato, and when they do, they eat the same tomato, and generally there's not a whole lot of taste to it. But here's what happens when you eat the organic tomato that you may not be aware of. It can reduce your risk of heart disease. Tufts and Boston University did research that found that lycopene was able to have a 30% reduction in the incidence of cardiovascular disease and coronary heart disease, and this was published in the British Journal of Nutrition. It is very rich in vitamins and minerals, especially the important ones like B1, 3, 5, 6, 7, C, folate, iron, potassium, magnesium, chromium, choline, zinc, and phosphorus. If you know someone who has smoked, having a daily glass, a big glass, of tomato juice could help them. Now, I would spike that juice. I would put the juice of 1 to 2 lemons or limes in there. That would be terrific. That's a great way to have a juice and some cayenne pepper, because tomatoes reduce the amount of damage done to your body's lungs, and they contain what is called chimeric acid and chlorogenic acid that work to protect the body from carcinogens that are produced from cigarette smoke. They also increase flavor. So anytime you, let's say you saute a dish, always with a low flame, and you use tomatoes, the enzymes and phytonutrients in the tomato actually increase the taste of the whole dish. They're very dense in phytonutrients, especially the flavanols, and hydroxycinnamic acid, glycosides, and even fatty acid derivatives. And the phenolic compounds in the organic tomatoes are just terrific. It improves digestion, helps prevent constipation, reduces the danger from statin drugs, prevents kidney and gallbladder stones, gives you healthier hair, healthier skin, especially if you have damaged skin from acne. It helps bone health, because it has a good ratio of calcium in them, and that helps. It strengthens your immune system, and it reduces blood clot risks. Hence, that clumping of the platelet that can end up in your bloodstream and cause a blockage, and that could cause a stroke or heart attack. It protects vision, and that's one of the reasons that people who have eye problems, macular degeneration, cataracts, glaucoma, I suggest not just lutein and lycopene and beta-carotene and the other eye nutrients, but also drinking tomato juice 3 times a day. It can prevent a stroke, according to Harvard Health Letter, because it naturally thins the blood and it has lycopene in it. And it restores biochemical balance in diabetics. This was in the Journal of Cell Biochemistry and Biophysics, that it's really good if you're diabetic. And for men, it helps reduce prostate cancer risks. The alpha-tomatine is a saponin phytonutrient, and it's in the tomato, and that helps alter metabolic activity in developing prostate cancer cells. And it helps women prevent breast cancer. And that was published in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute. So on all levels, tomatoes are a super food. Now, which foods should you avoid or use if you want to prevent 8 age-related vision loss? This is from Tufts University. Quote, so you are hit by a post-lunch sugar craving. Which of these are more likely for you to choose? A slice of devil food cake with icing or an orange? Be honest, if you choose the orange slices, you could safely skip this post. But if you eat the cake and cream buns or the go-to comfort foods, this is an eye-opener. Why? Because now Tufts University is showing that what you're getting is a high blood sugar rush, and you're going to have problems with your glycemic index. And when your blood sugar goes up, that's really bad for your eyes, and that can contribute to age-related macular degeneration. So go for the fresh food, fresh juices. And I'm happy to tell you that everywhere in the city, I'm seeing more juice bars open up. One just opened a block south of our office, and another is open two blocks north. They're both doing extremely well. I commend, first of all, the people doing it, because these are small little neighborhood stores, and I'm always wanting more small neighborhood stores. I was just walking down to Lincoln Center late last night, and I went by a building that only had two stores on the entire block. And one was a Duane Reade, the other was a Marshalls. And we see more of what I call the malling of Manhattan, where mall stores, brand name stores, are taking over what was three, four, five, or six small little stores. And just a block up, you have 13 stores in a block, all small. So I certainly would like to see more of those. But juicing is big now, all over the United States. More and more Americans are drinking juices because they're more educated, they know it's good for you. And finally, I want to bring this to your attention. We will be having an original, in-depth, investigative report, a white paper, on the scandal at the CDC, the whistleblower who has now been outed, and how this impacts all of the families who had their children vaccinated with the MMR vaccine, the measles, mumps, rubella. We will also be bringing in Dr. Wakefield, Andrew Wakefield, who was excoriated and vilified because he said there, along with a team of researchers back in the late 1990s, that there could be an association between the vaccine, especially the mumps part, and gut problems in children who develop autism spectrum disorder. They published in the peer-reviewed journal The Lancet, but then the pharmaceutical industries went after him behind the scenes, and they had a lot of problems. This exonerates him. He was telling the truth. They were lying. But now we have someone who's going to come forward and say on this program who they were, name them and their positions, and how they got away with it, what was discussed inside the inner sanctum when they were conspiring to cover all this up. So all that's going to be heard exclusively on this program within the next 5 days. This is from Ethan Huff from Natural News. Quote, U.S. Congressman says, quote, incestuous relationship between the CDC and vaccine manufacturers need to be scrutinized. Now, this is a Florida Democrat. Is Bill Posey from Florida's 8th District. He said the CDC simply can't be trusted to honestly investigate vaccine safety because of its close relationship with the vaccine industry. Now, he's known as Mr. Accountability, and he told the vaccine industry watchdog, Dr. Brian Hooker, who we had on this program last week, during a recent interview, that the CDC has an extensive history of vaccine industry infiltration. From scam artist Dr. Paul Thorensen, to the CDC researcher who, he was the one indicted for stealing grant money awarded by the Agency for Autism Research, and he's the one who did like 40 reports showing there was no connection between autism and vaccines. He lied about everything, and yet the CDC has not repudiated and walked back all those articles. They still use his research to say why you shouldn't be concerned. Well, we should. And also, what about Dr. Julia Gerbringen, the current president of Merck's vaccine division, who used to be director of the CDC, and she went directly from the CDC overseeing vaccine safety to running Merck's vaccine division. This kind of revolving door simply shouldn't be accepted. And concerning Thorson's role in supposedly vetting the safety vaccines, Representative Posey says this corrupt Danish researcher collaborated with the CDC on dozens of papers claiming that vaccines are safe, as opposed to just the one claimed by current CDC director of the National Center for Birth Defects and Developmental Disorders, Dr. Colleen Boyle. This means that the entire repository of studies claiming by the CDC as evidence that vaccines do not cause autism was manipulated and intentionally distorted to protect the vaccine industry. It is my belief that we should call for a special prosecutor to be brought in and to do a thorough investigation on the CDC, the people in the CDC, now that we have a whistleblower saying it's all corrupt, and on this vaccine, and so those people can be held accountable. So that you'll be hearing in depth on this program, and we'll keep you apprised of that. One way that you're going to know that the drought is real is when you go to buy some olive oil and you find out you're paying 40 to 50% higher prices. This is from Madrid, and they're showing that there's a huge drought in the south of Spain, the world's biggest producer of the yellow gold olive oil, and it is the and they're having the driest months ever there. And in the second biggest grower, that's Italy, the bacteria that is attacking the trees and the branches are worse than they've ever seen it. Quote, prices will rise to 40% because there will be fewer olives and therefore less oil produced. The quality will not be affected. There is no cure. The only solution is to burn the infected trees to stop bacteria spreading quickly. So that's one of the causes of drought. And by the way, you're going to see even greater drought in China, Australia, and the United States in the upcoming almost immediate sense. There's a new law that privatizes water, and I wanted to share this with you. This is from Mint Press News from Kerry Byron. Quote, a major piece of legislation funding the development and improvement of water-related infrastructure passed Congress, and President Obama signed it in law, yet public interest groups warned that a key provision in the law would complicate public investment in drinking water and wastewater systems in big cities and small towns alike. The end result, they say, would be to strengthen privately managed or privately owned water systems while leaving the federal government to take on the risk of these investments. Essentially, we, the public, would be subsidizing water privatization, and we would be paying for the water on top of that. Quote, this law will facilitate the privatization of water systems and prioritize funding for privatized systems. And that was from Mary Grant from Food and Water Watch. The basic problem is that it will only fund up to 45% of project costs, but also stipulates that the rest cannot be made up through the use of tax-exempt bonds, yet such bonds are the primary way in which local governments fund infrastructure projects. So why would they even try to use this type of funding? In any case, what I am seeing in my travels around the United States and my research is that some major hedge funds and equity partnerships and investment brokers are going around the country and they're buying up water rights, and including in drought-stricken areas. And because of the power at the state level of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, for 35 years secretly lobbying your state legislators, secretly meeting with them and giving them draft legislation that this legislator goes back and passes as law in the state without the public ever being aware of who really wrote all this. The legislators didn't write any of it. The 300 different corporations that are supportive of ALEC, like Pepsi-Cola, for example, and Verizon, McDonald's, they write the legislation. So then that means, and this is one of those situations that is going to make itself apparent very quickly. Let's say you go to turn on the water and you find out that not a lot of water's coming out. So there's a meeting, and the town supervisor, the city council, says, we're in a severe drought, so we're going to have to ration the water. Well, you may have your water ration, but what about those who came in and bought the aquifer rights and gave the town some money for it, or whoever owned it? They don't have any rationing. They can take all the water out of there they choose, even if it means you have no water. And so then you go up to California and you see that there's a big move all over California to buy up water rights. We should not allow any water rights to be sold. I believe that we should never, under any circumstances, allow any commodity to be traded or purchased that is in the public domain. Water, food, those should not be touched because we need them. But now our government, very quietly, without any fanfare, has allowed just that. For those living in California, there is a secret internal document urging the closure of the California nuclear power plant. And Deirdre Fulton from Common Dreams shared this with us in the report, and it was written a year ago, but it was not made public. A former federal inspector expressly stated that he was very concerned over California's last operating nuclear plant, the Diablo Canyon, and that what would happen if there's a strong quake. There's a 42-page document. It was filed July of 2013. Dr. Michael Peck, the National Regulatory Commission's former senior resident inspector at Diablo Canyon, calls for the plant to be shut down, quote, pending demonstration that safety functions can be met at the higher seismic stress levels. Now, observers criticized the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's withholding the report, though Peck asked that his dissent, known as a deferring professional opinion written in response to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's decision to let the plant's twin reactors keep running despite the failure of both plant operator Pacific Gas and Electric Company and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to conduct a rigorous safety analysis. They did not. Hence, you have no real safety standards. And so that's where we stand. Quote, I find it completely disrespectful that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission hid these concerns for all this time. And in response to the revelations, California's Senate Environment and Public Works Committee announced it would hold hearings into how the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has handled Dr. Peck's recommendations. I believe that every nuclear power plant in the United States should be shut down. I don't believe that any of them should be operational, and especially Indian Point. The greatest concentration of people in the United States are on a nuclear power plant 38 miles north of Manhattan. And by the way, just this month, a massive coronal ejection from the sun, a sunburst or a solar flare went out. It didn't go by the Earth, but had we been in its field, you wouldn't be hearing the show today. How many people are prepared for that? So it's not, is this going to happen? It's when. It is inevitable. And yet we see nothing being done to deconstruct the old archaic electrical grid and to install standalone, safety maintained, meaning there's backup systems, redundant systems, so if a solar storm hits, these will not be knocked off power. And then we should replace all these around the United States. It would only cost a little over $1 billion, a tiny amount to save America from rescinding into the dark ages. But if you doubt me, what do you think would happen if for 3 months there was no power in the United States? None. None at all. No refrigeration, no air conditioning, no heating, no telephone, telegraph, no computer, no stoplights, nothing. No elevator power, no toilet, no water. What do you think would become of the average citizen? For this segment of our program, I want to focus on Monsanto in the Ukraine. a very good piece from GM Food, and it talks about this relationship. Let me quote Joyce Nelson on this. She says, "Finally, a little-known aspect of the crisis in Ukraine is receiving some international attention. On July 28th, the California-based Oakland Institute received a report revealing that the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, under terms of their $17 billion loan to Ukraine, would open that country to genetically modified crops and genetically modified organisms in agriculture. The report is entitled, Walking on the West Side, the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund in the Ukraine Conflict. Now, in late 2013, the then president of the Ukraine rejected a European Union Association agreement tied to $17 billion International Monetary Fund loan. Why? Because the terms are only now being revealed. Instead, the Yanukovych chose a Russian aid package worth less, $15 billion, plus a discount on Russian natural gas. His decision was a major factor in the ensuing deadly protest that led to his ouster from office in February 2014 and the ongoing crisis we see now, which the United States and Europe has supported the fascists who are in power now. According to the Oakland Institute, quote, whereas Ukraine does not allow the use of genetically modified organisms in agriculture, Article 404 of the European Union Agreement, which relates to agriculture, includes a clause that has generally gone unnoticed. It indicates, among other things, that both parties will cooperate to extend the use of biotechnologies. There is no doubt that this provision meets the expectations of the agricultural industry, as observed by Michael Cox, research director, and, quote, Ukraine and to a wider extent Eastern Europe are among the most promising growth markets for farm equipment giant John Deere, as well as seed producers Monsanto and DuPont. Now, Ukrainian law bars farmers from growing genetically modified crops. It was considered the breadbasket of Europe because it has some of the richest deep black soil on the planet, and it's ideal for growing grains. In fact, in 2012, Ukrainian farmers harvested more than 20 million tons of corn. So here's Monsanto's connection. In May of 2013, Monsanto announced plans to invest $140 million in a non-GMO corn seed plant in Ukraine. With Monsanto Ukraine spokesperson confirming that, quote, we will be working with conventional seeds only because in Ukraine only conventional seeds are allowed for production and importation. But by November 2013, six large Ukrainian agricultural associations had prepared draft amendments to the law pushing for, quote, creating, testing, transportation, and use of genetically modified organisms regarding the legalization of GM seeds in Ukraine. Now, the president of the Ukrainian Grain Association told a press conference in Kiev, quote, we could mull over this issue for a long time, but we, jointly with the agriculture associations, have signed two letters to change the law on biosecurity in which we propose the legalization of the use of GM seeds, which has been tested in the United States for a long time, for our producers. And the Agriculture Association's draft amendments coincided with the terms of the European Union Association Agreement and the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund $17 billion loan. So what we have Monsanto now getting its genetically modified grains into the Ukraine with the new administration. The last one, not so much. Now, this is from WikiLeaks. These are the cables. August 2011, WikiLeaks released U.S. diplomatic cables showing that the United States State Department has been lobbying worldwide for Monsanto and other biotechnology corporations like DuPont, Syngenta, Bayer, and Dow, lobbying on their behalf. The U.S. nonprofit Food and Water Watch, after combing through 5 years of these cables, released its report entitled Biotech Ambassadors: How the U.S. State Department Promotes the Seed Industry's Global Agenda. And that was on May 14, 2013. The report simply shows that the United States State Department has lobbied foreign governments to adopt pro-agra biotechnology GMO policies and laws. And then they promoted a whole public relations campaign to improve the image of biotechnology. And they're fully on the side of the biotech industry. So then they also threatened any country with sanctions of different types if they didn't get on board. Now, the U.S.-Ukrainian Business Council 16-member executive committee is packed with U.S. agribusiness companies, including representatives from Monsanto, John Deere, DuPont, Pioneer, Eli Lilly, and Cargill. And the council's 20 senior advisors include James Green, former head of NATO in Ukraine, and others who are all affiliated with Big Pharma or Big Agra. So the Ukrainian people are now going to be forced to grow genetically modified foods where for all this time they have refused. So that's something we didn't know, now we do. I also want to take some time to share some insights from Dar Jamil from Truthout. This is about the toxic legacy of uranium mining in New Mexico. Now, what we have is we have a big problem, and that is that we did not tell the people that there was going to be a health problem from the radiation, even though the government scientists and private industry scientists knew. All we did was he exploited that uranium, and that left them decades later with different sicknesses, including cancers. Quote, "I strongly believe I'm sick because of years of work underground. My job was to be behind miners, and I had to make trips into tunnels not ventilated, which had high readings of radon gas and being exposed daily to contaminated water. Radon diesel fumes and dust also were there. For months after his job ended, a man named King said he was coughing up black stuff in my phlegm, where it was coming out of my nose. Now, on his second doctor's visit, they found that he had major health problems. He had fatigue, shortness of breath. He had contamination, and it was serious. And he's not alone. Thousands of former uranium mine and mill workers remain sick with symptoms that have now been attributed to their work, as well as countless other people, mostly indigenous, who live in close proximity to these contaminated sites. In New Mexico, a disproportionate number of unremediated uranium mines and mill sites are on lands traditionally used and occupied by the Navajo. Thus, a disproportionate amount of the pollution from uranium sites occurs in Navajo communities. So the Navajo continue to bear the brunt of health problems associated with these toxic sites. Why? It's simple. Because if you've ever been out to any of these reservations, and I have, then you know that this isn't like a major community where you have clean water and clean soil. The Navajo families have bathed and showered and washed clothes in and played in and drunk radioactive water. They didn't know it. Their men worked in the mines while breathing carcinogenic gases, then spread radionuclides throughout their family. Simply by returning home from work, it's on their shoes, it's on their clothes. No one told them. But it wasn't until the spill was designated as a Superfund site in 1983 that the Navajo, who were being irradiated and sickened every second of every day for more than 30 years, learned the truth. Chris Shuey, an environmental health specialist with the Southwest Research and Information Center in Albuquerque, has been working with Navajo communities affected by uranium mining and milling for more than 30 years. He says, "The health of people living near the uranium mills and mines and the communities impacted by uranium mining and processing have not been well studied." But he and others have been studying the impact since uranium mining era ended in the mid-1960s. Quote, "What has been known for decades is that men working in the early mines were suffering from excess risk an incidence of respiratory disease, malignant and non-malignant lung cancer, and disease at rates far beyond rates in the rest of the U.S. But that is only the beginning of the problem. Let me share with you some of the history of radiation. Uranium mining in New Mexico kicked off near the beginning of the atomic age when, in the 1950s, a Navajo man discovered uranium while herding his sheep. This was what essentially launched the uranium mining boom in the West. At first, the federal government was the sole purchaser of uranium for atomic weapons and experimental nuclear power. During that time, there were a tremendous number of uranium mines in New Mexico and throughout the Southwest. Eric Sense, a staff attorney for the New Mexico Environmental Law Center in Santa Fe, told Truthout, "It was the heyday of uranium mining in New Mexico, and everybody thought they were going to get rich from what quickly evolved into a typical rush. Not unlike the gold rush in California, and by the 1960s, the private sector became involved along with federal government subsidies and support." One of the native Navajos described his former company as one being so caught up in the profit-making they chose to neglect taking proper safety measures for the workers. Proper OSHA, which is Occupational Safety and Health Administration safety practices, were not used on a daily basis. Quote, "We were not given respirators to use underground. I know co-workers who drank the water dripping in the tunnels. We're walking down the tunnels and heavy equipment is rolling by and all that dust. There was no safety for us. We knew when a safety inspection was coming because all the tunnels not being used were barricaded. Workers were told to use respirators and other safety gear and do things that weren't done on a daily basis. Then after the inspection, a couple of days later, it was back to normal. No safety, no respirators." In the mid-1980s, the uranium market crashed, and most of the mines and mills in New Mexico were shuttered. But even before then, folks suspected there were problems with uranium milling and mining, things like environmental contamination, public health issues, lung cancer, lung disease for the miners. So the uranium mining industry started to become suspect from a health perspective. And during the late 1990s, communities affected by the uranium mining and milling contaminants became more engaged. That's when people began to realize that the legacy from uranium mining and milling was not one of promised riches, but more one of environmental contamination, and they got stuck with the bill. That leads us to the impact upon human health. Despite the obvious health risks associated with exposure to radiation that have been known for decades, very few studies exist that link Navajo illnesses to the uranium mines and mills. This is what one of them has to say. Quote, "As with anything nuclear, good information is one of the first casualties, so there's not a lot of information of environmental and health impacts from uranium mining and milling. I think this is probably by design, because if those data were available, nobody would tolerate any uranium mining anywhere. Once the full impacts of uranium mining and milling became clear, it's going to show there is a tremendous devastation." Despite the information blackout, it was clear from the beginning that uranium mining was causing health problems. And a short time after beginning to work in the uranium mines, Navajo men began to be diagnosed with lung cancer. Navajo miners, since they were non-smoking, their lung effects had more pronounced importance from an epidemiological perspective. Over the years, it's now very well accepted worldwide in all scientific and medical groups that underground miners and uranium workers are disproportionately affected by the materials around them, like radon gases and radioactive decay products. By the 1960s, the U.S. Public Health Service linked cumulative exposure to uranium and lung cancer, clarifying the causes being exposure to radiation. Other studies have proven that even decades after they ceased being exposed to radiation, Navajo miners had death rates and risks for lung cancer and other respiratory problems 400% higher than non-miners. Today, thanks in large part to the work of the SRIC and Jantz and others who are concerned, there's now a greater awareness that you have higher rates of kidney disease linked to the drinking of contaminated water within the Navajo population. And the information base of the health impacts of uranium mining and milling is growing. And what they have found is that closer that you live to the mines and the more you came into contact with that waste, mind you, no one told them the waste was a problem, so all that waste was everywhere around them. There was no home that was not within a distance of that waste, the uranium milling and mining and tailings, and so everyone was exposed. The illnesses also include hypertension, autoimmune disease, high blood pressure, rheumatoid arthritis, kidney disease, all because of living close to mine waste. And what they're also beginning to see in terms of public health impacts is lung cancer caused by radon gas. So uranium is also an estrogen mimicker as well as an endocrine disruptor. It's becoming clear that living in proximity to any uranium mine results in a range of health issues, from cancer to kidney disease to hypertension to heart disease to autoimmune dysfunction. And while it is obvious that exposure to uranium would be likely to occur around the mines, mill sites can be equally contaminated. At the mills, uranium ore was crushed, then soaked in sulfuric acid to extract the uranium, before even more chemicals were added. What was left was radioactive cocktail, which was usually stored in vast, unprotected ponds that leached and continued to leach contaminants like radiation and heavy metals into the groundwater. An article titled Once Upon a Mine by Kerry Arnold, published in February in the journal Environmental Health Perspectives, which is an arm of the National Institutes of Health, from which many of these citations were borrowed, added, quote, a study of 266 cases and matched controls among Navajo births over 18 years suggested children of women who live near abandoned uranium sites are 1.83 times more likely to have one of 33 selected defects. Among these defects, thought to be connected to radiation, chromosomal disorders, single gene mutations, as well as distinctly non-related defects, such as death due to obstetrical complications. Now, other studies have shown how uranium chemical and radioactive properties can damage DNA. And so radiation, heavy metals, other contaminants from uranium mines and milling continues to leak as I speak right now. They're invisible. You won't see them. You won't taste them. But they're in the groundwater. They're in the air. They're everywhere. So, yes, it's a local issue for them, but it's also a national issue that no one told them, no one protected them, no one helped them. And so it goes. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. Now let's go to Maryland, where Paul Shapiro is standing by. He is the Vice President of Farm Animal Protection for the Humane Society of the United States, where he implements legislative and corporate campaigns to improve the plight of farm animals and animal welfare reforms in the agricultural industry. He's regarded as one of our nation's primary authorities on farm animal advocacy. And earlier, he was the founder of the organization Compassion Over Killing, and was a farm animal cruelty investigator uncovering misleading information on factory farm products. And the Society's website is humanesociety.org. Nice to have you with us today, Paul.
Gary, it's an honor to be on with you. Thanks so much for having me.
For a president who ran on a campaign that would tackle corporate corruption and advocate greater transparency in the workings of government and banks and private industries, President Obama has accomplished almost, in my opinion, nothing except the opposite of his promises. One legislative policy implemented during his presidency has been the agricultural gag laws that protect the farm industry from public transparency and scrutiny, and this includes unhealthy hygienic conditions in factory farms as well as animal cruelty and abuse. And there is also the efforts to clamp down on all whistleblowing, especially on farms. So please begin with laying out for us the substance of these ag gag rulings, and then what, in your estimation, are the fundamental reasons why the White House and Congress want to protect the farm industry from public scrutiny and oversight instead of protecting the public and the animals?
Thanks so much, Gary. In recent years, there has been a raft of animal cruelty and food safety whistleblowing exposés at our nation's slaughter plants and factory farms. And these exposés have led to meat recalls, slaughter plant shutdowns, criminal animal cruelty convictions, and more. But the meat industry's response to these exposés has not been to try to prevent these abuses from taking place. Rather, it's really just been to try to prevent Americans from finding out about those abuses in the first place. And the primary way they're doing that is exactly as you're saying, with these proposed ag gag laws. Now, the overwhelming majority of states that have introduced such legislation have defeated them, but some states, a few of them, have passed these ag gag laws that essentially make it a crime to blow the whistle at a factory farm. They either make it a crime simply to take a photo or a video of an agribusiness operation without the owner's consent, or they make it impossibly difficult, in fact, even criminally difficult, for a whistleblower to gain access to one of these facilities in the first place. So the meat industry is grasping at straws. It's desperate to keep Americans in the dark about how meat is produced in our country because it knows that the more that people learn about how their meat is being produced, the greater the outrage is going to be, both because of the torment of animals in this food system and because of the food safety and other associated problems as well.
To me, there's just a disconnect in common sense. If you're an American eating an animal, first you should be aware you don't need anything in that animal for health. For those of us who are vegans, we can not only show that we live longer lives, are healthier, have less heart disease and cancer, but let's say you're not a vegan, and no one in my family is a vegan. No one's even a vegetarian. You know, everyone I know, including all my friends, are meat eaters. So then I ask them, well, what about the cruelty to the animal? Okay, well, then I'll buy free-range and organic. And I said, well, how do you know how the animal was treated? Because that's not always an indication, just the fact that it's organic, that it's going to be better. Could you take us through what happens that the people may not be aware of, including those that don't want to see an animal hurt or treated badly, even though all animals at the end of the day, no matter how well you treated them or grass you fed them or free range, you're still going to slaughter them. But what is wrong with the way animals are fed and treated before they get to a person's plate?
Sure, Gary. Well, in short, more than 9 out of 10 of the animal products, the meat, the milk, the eggs, that you see on grocery store shelves and in restaurants in the United States come from factory farms, not these family farms. They're coming from places where animals are treated more like units of production on an assembly line than like living, feeling individuals who they are. So just to give a couple examples, in the egg industry, it's typical for egg-laying hens to be locked inside of cages that are so cramped that each bird has less space than an iPad on which to live for her entire life for over a year prior to slaughter. It's difficult to imagine a more miserable existence, and yet more than 9 out of 10 egg cartons you see in America come from birds who were immobilized in those type of tiny cages. Similarly, in the pork industry, pigs are by the millions are locked up inside of cages that are so small they're barely larger than their own bodies. They're unable even to turn around for years on end. Imagine just taking a 500-pound animal who's intelligent and social. I mean, pigs do even better on IQ tests than dogs. Researchers can easily teach them to sit on command and more. And yet, locking one of these animals up in a cage barely larger than her own body and immobilizing her, and she develops pressure sores from laying in the same position all day and all night, She becomes lame from lack of exercise. Her muscles are atrophying, and eventually she goes insane from this forced immobilization and enters into a state of what would be considered like a clinical depression and learned helplessness, and they realize they're just never getting out. And that's not just happening to one pig. That's happening to millions of pigs in the pork industry in the United States. In the chicken meat industry, you see that the birds have been genetically manipulated to grow so obese so fast that many of them have difficulty even walking more than a few pitiful steps prior to collapsing underneath the bulk of their own weight. These aren't exceptions to the rule. These aren't just anomalies. These types of abuses that we're talking about right now are standard industry practices in the meat, egg, and dairy industries. And so a lot of people are doing, like what you're talking about, Gary, and you and I are both vegans, and that's a choice that a lot of people are making. But a lot of Americans are may not be becoming vegan, but they are reducing their meat consumption. They're eating less meat. They're participating in things like Meatless Mondays, or maybe they're participating in something like Mark Bittman, the New York Times columnist. He's proposed an idea through his new best-selling book, Vegan Before 6 p.m., where people are vegan for the first two-thirds of the day, but not the last one. And so the idea of eating less meat is certainly becoming far more popular, far more mainstream in America today than it was even 5 or 10 years ago.
There was a time, Paul, when if you did a film on vegan anything, you couldn't get anyone to watch it and no one to show it.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have Samsara, Fork Over Knives, Food Inc., Meet Your Meat, and my newest film, which I have not released yet, Chew On This, which I don't know if you've seen it, but I'll get you a copy.
Thank you.
And these are very well received. In fact, we've won 20 film festivals or and official entries based upon just this film in the last 2 months. So clearly people are paying interest to it. And in this one, I simply show how animals are treated, including on organic farms, which I do not see that they're being treated in the way they should, but also the whole myth that we need meat in order to have strong muscles. Could you address the fact that we are seeing more films, more books, more articles, and a greater awareness within the country, especially among young people, that maybe it's not such a cool idea to not be aware and conscious of where your meat comes from?
Sure, Gary. You're hitting the nail right on the head. The fact of the matter is that when I became a vegan 21 years ago, people didn't know what the word meant. They didn't even know how to pronounce it. I mean, most people had no idea about any of this. But today, this idea of vegan eating has moved very firmly from the margins into the mainstream. When you've got cultural icons like Bill Clinton and Al Gore and Bill Gates and Oprah and Ellen touting and extolling the benefits of plant-based eating, you know this concept of eating more plants and eating fewer animals has really arrived in the cultural mainstream. So it's not just these cultural icons, though. Even much of the polling shows that people are eating less meat. We may not be becoming a vegetarian nation by any means, but people are eating less meat. And part of that is because of a desire to prevent cruelty and violence against animals. Part of it also has to do with a desire to try to curb some of the greatest environmental challenges that we face, like climate change, water, soil, and air degradation, and more. And the meat industry is linked to as one of the main culprits for all of those environmental problems. And importantly, people want to look and feel better. We're a nation that is plagued by overweight and obesity. We're plagued by various so-called diseases of affluence, like heart disease, type 2 diabetes, various forms of cancer. And the studies show that eating less meat reduces your risk of those types of illnesses. So whether it's people who want to have a lighter impact on the earth or have a lighter conscience because of the treatment of animals, or they want to have a lighter body weight themselves, people are choosing to eat more and more vegetarian and vegan foods and fewer animal-based foods, and the world will be a better place because of it.
Well, thank you very much, Paul Shapiro, for getting out there, letting us know about the gag ag. We should start to fight the gag ag in our states. We should know that ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, representing some of these big meat industry companies were behind a lot of these gag orders. We should also let our legislators know we don't want factory farming to be hidden, the problems. We don't want whistleblowers to be prosecuted. If there's something wrong, we want to be able to film it, talk about it, without the fear of going to jail for it.
Amen. I couldn't agree with you more, Gary.
And it's thehumanesociety.org is the website. And Paul Shapiro, my guest. Thank you, Paul.
Gary, thank you again. Have a great day, my friend.
Bye. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.